Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor Dan Stevens, who rose to fame in the popular British period drama Downton Abbey. And don't say you didn't get a little weepy when good old Matthew Crawley met his untimely death due to a lack of seatbelts and a desire to leave British costume drama behind. I know I did. But Dan had this crazy idea to move to America and test his mettle in roles and environs as far from Highclere Castle as possible. You might think he was mad for leaving a show at the height of its popularity, but Dan's pretty comfortable with madness. As he explains, filmmaking is an exercise in collective madness. It's one mad person saying, "I have this mad idea. What do you think?" When you find another mad person who thinks that you're maybe not so mad, it's the most beautiful thing in the world. An appetite for expanding his resume has led Dan to team up with fellow madman Noah Hawley as the lead in his mind-boggling television show, Legion, very loosely based on the Marvel comic books. Dan plays David Haller, a seemingly schizophrenic mutant whose mind has been hijacked by a disturbing and hilarious parasite, played by a maniacal Aubrey Plaza. And if that sounds confusing, well, you don't know the half of it. Dan joins off camera to discuss what he loves about the uncertainty of Legion, how he found his voice for Beauty and the Beast, why you might just catch him at the local deli taking a new accent out for a spin, and why we must hold on to our invisible wristwatches. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me. I love how everything suddenly went black and white.
Well, I know, right?
It's really cool.
Yeah, it's that click. Once it clicks,
magic.
All color is gone. You know, I've wanted to have you along here for a long time. And my daughter is a giant fan of Beauty and the Beast. And
great.
So you're responsible for me doing a lot of singing with her.
Good.
And you know, obviously my wife and I watch Downton like every other person in the world.
And like every other good American.
Yes. And then watching your career since that has been fascinating. The choices you've made and Legion is the craziest thing on television. So I'm very happy to have you here. I'm pleased to see that you still have a British accent.
Just about.
I mean, honestly, Everything I've seen you in lately, you play an American.
Yeah. It's easier once you get over here, I think, to do that.
Yeah.
I don't know what you call it, but it's like a form of Tourette's, where if I sit with somebody with an accent for long enough, I start to do it. My vowels change, my things happen.
So you could do this entire conversation like an American?
Maybe. I'll try not to, but it'll happen at some point.
Really?
And also, I think just living here, you have to modify your speech somewhat. You can't ask for a glass of water in a restaurant very often.
They'll say, well,
you get really blank looks if you ask for water. And so you just have to say water.
Right.
Like that. But and things like that. And there's only so many times you can sort of insist on saying water. So there's a certain type of Englishman that will just insist on saying water for life and will be very thirsty.
Well, do you enjoy that part of the process of you know, taking on different dialects and accents?
Yes.
And you do?
Yeah, very much. Always have done, really. My ear and the voice is sort of, a way into all sorts of things. And I've always enjoyed just what you can conjure about a character purely from the way that they speak or the way that they hold their head or something, you know. And that then, as I started thinking about things more and getting more into my work, you know, obviously translates into a whole physicality. And that's a whole different thing. But purely from the voice alone, just working in radio and audiobooks and things like that, the imagination that you can access purely through the ear is a magical thing.
Do you just learn the scripted lines or do you try to learn the language?
Always the language. It's got to sort of sit in it's just got to sit in your throat. And I certainly know when I feel like I'm doing an accent and when I feel like it's sort of embedded. I think the most helpful thing any dialect coach ever told me was that there is no American accent. There's no one American accent. You've nailed it, son. Like, everybody here is, you know, has a very slightly different accent. And sure, there's like the Southern accent and the New York accent or whatever, but even within New York, you'll find,
you know,
within a block, you'll find 20 different accents. Or in LA, you know, the Californian thing, you know, there's hundreds of little permutations of that.
Do you pick up on those things?
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that because in England, we're hyper-exposed to that. It's a tiny, tiny island, a mad little collection of islands, but the range of dialects within that tiny space is huge. And in America, you can go, I mean, in Texas, you can go, you know, 400 miles and you'll hear roughly the same accent. You go 400 miles in England, you might be hard pressed to understand somebody.
Right. Now, when you start to get one down, like, you know, when you're getting close to filming, do you ever kind of go out and be that character just to sort of get a feeling of it out in the world?
Oh, sure. I don't know how much interaction that involves. It depends on the character. And I suppose more recently it's a bit stranger because somebody might recognize you and so they know what you sound like. It's not
right.
Like, you know, a few years back where I could, you know, rock up into a deli in New York and I could use any voice I like and nobody would know.
Now, did you do that?
Oh, almost certainly. I like the feeling of working. Like I like the sense of exploration, of research. You know, though, the feeling like I'm learning, you know, if I'm fulfilling a character properly in my mind, I'm learning something about the world, about people, about the way things have always been done or the way that things might be done or something,
right.
You know, but I feel like I'm absorbing new information and sort of feeling my way out through this, this particular character.
Right.
But at the same time, I love the sense of play. And, you know, particularly in theater, I find, you know, that sense of being present and alive and playful is really, you know, that's the ultimate goal.
Well, you wrote an essay that I read called The Invisible Watch.
Okay.
And this is for your literary online magazine.
Yes.
Called The Junket.
And yeah.
You talk in this essay about how technology sort of steamrolls our dreamscape or our imagination. And you managed to, in that essay, articulate something that I feel on a daily basis, which is the world that I grew up in didn't have as much competition for my imagination. And the world that our kids are growing up in, it's a land grab for anything left, any original thought.
Attention and time, yeah.
Everything.
It's a massive currency now. Yeah.
Everything. And what I took away from reading that was that, you know, that's an important piece of real estate for you and how to give that to your kids. And I don't know, I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
I think we all inherently have incredible imaginations as children. I don't think, you know, it's very rare that there's such thing as an unimaginative child.
Right.
I think there's a point at which certain schools, certain institutions, maybe certain styles of parenting, certain friendship groups start to kind of put a lid on that because your imagination is inherently unusual. It's your own and it's really freaking weird.
Like, yeah.
It should be. And as soon as people start telling you, oh, that's a bit weird, like maybe just, you know, put a lid on that or soften that edge or whatever, then we start to kind of curb that. And it's funny you mentioned that essay because I haven't thought about that for a long time, but it just seemed to embody something that, you know, our age was developing this technology, is developing this technology, you know, whilst trying to retain something that's at the core, that there's a commonwealth of experience with certain things. And I think imagination is one of those where it's either a byproduct of just being human or it's for the benefit of mankind in some way. But it really exists, you know? Like, it's not, we're not making this shit up. Like, the imagination is real. And it's inherently magical. And it's a wonderful thing. Now, granted, could we all just, like, wander around indulging our imagination the whole time? Maybe not. There is a time and a place, I guess, once you grow up and go out into the world. I guess by doing what I do, I'm...
You're indulging your imagination.
I am indulging my imagination.
I'm
sort of safeguarding quite a lot of space for that to continue. But I just see it in kids, and I just, you know, I want to foster that as much as possible, really.
Well, what struck me about it is that there's never been a generation that had, you know, that something was after that. Imagination was sort of a birthright right up until now. And as an actor, I would think that you have to keep those pathways wide open.
I think it's healthy to try, you know, because that's how you find the good stuff. That's how you find the unusual choice, or that's how the unusual role or the perfect role for you will suddenly spring up.
Yeah, if you don't know you, then how can you find the perfect role for you?
Yeah, things will just, you know, things just ring bells because of how I imagine I would do this. I was like, oh, I can see this, I can visualize this, I can see me playing this, I can see how, you know, in conversation with the director, you know, something will be inspired, and I can imagine that. But that initial spark comes from an imaginative leap. And part of that is self-knowledge. It's a certain amount of courage, I suppose.
Yeah.
But yeah, I used to love doing radio plays because it's pure imagination. You know, you stand at a microphone in a room like this and dressed however you like, and you could be anywhere doing anything right then and there. There's a guy in the background crunching leaves or scattering, you know, light, clanking chains live behind you. And he's imagining what that sounds like, and he's listening, and he's, you know, and you're tapping into the listener's imagination just by, you know, just by tapping into their ear. They're seeing that world. They're picturing you wearing, I don't know, a frock coat and, you know,
right,
riding a horse. And I wasn't, you know, and that's magic.
Totally. Judi Dench, I read that she told you that that actors have to remember that they're not proper grown-ups.
Yes, not proper grown-ups.
When she said that to you, what did that conjure up for you? Or what was
well, just
that
the
an
word grown-ups. I
remember,
she said grown-ups because grown-ups is a childish word. Like, you know,
yeah.
Adults is an adult word. But grown-up, we're not proper grown-ups. And she's really not, you know. There's this sort of impish, eternally playful thing about her. And getting to learn, you know, just from standing in the wings, watching somebody like that play with her fellow cast and the audience and the playwright and sometimes the director as well, you know, teasing the director, because once you're on stage that night, that's the amazing thing about theater. You know, film is a director's medium, I believe, but theater can still be hijacked by the actors.
Right. Right.
You know, you can do all the work in rehearsal and
there's no cut.
you sit back in that first night or that first preview and yeah, it's just happening. And, you know, it's why theater directors get very, very stressed because they can't quite control it. And she takes that control and just, yeah, it's a dazzling thing to watch.
So I guess trying to put these two things together of the invisible watch and this idea that you're not proper grown-ups, that's where as an artist, that's where you want to be, right?
Yeah.
And there's no rules to follow that that you can't make up on your own.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a certain amount of training that comes into that. I didn't train formally as an actor. I did stand-up comedy at college. I then, you know, went on and did Shakespearean theater with the Peter Hall Company, which was a formal training on the job of verse speaking. But I didn't do that sort of, you know, drama school route. But I learned through, you know, the formal training that I got from Peter Hall, speaking verse, doing Noel Coward, you know, which is very, very precise, you know, incredibly tersely written dialogue, and the tempo of that, you know, finding the musicality of great writing is something that he really taught me. So that really played into, yeah, I mean, that, learning the rules and then learning how to break them, I think, it was a huge part of that.
Because I think this is one thing that happens in every discipline of art, is that you've got to go through that period where you learn the structure, or else you're not going to be able to break it with that assurance.
I think so. I mean, there are some people who are just out of the gate, just instinctively, whatever. But I felt like I wanted some sort of structure,
uh-huh.
But I didn't want to go the whole hog and institutionalize it. I was very keen to kind of learn on the job from, you know, there is a kind of weird osmosis, I think, that happens when you're just watching great people do their thing in whatever department. There's something just very, I don't know, I enjoy watching people who are good at their work, you
right.
know, whether that's behind the camera or whatever. There's a neat flow to watching that that I get a real kick out of, and I think that sort of reflects back. It's, you know, when a set is great and when a set really works, it feels like that. It sort of there's like a mutual feeding of everybody's enthusiasm and skill.
Well, that's got to be true for Legion, because, and we should talk about Legion because
sure.
because, I mean, we're talking sort of around all of the craft and how you find your way into a craft and how you observe and
yeah.
break rules, but
and then along comes Legion.
And then along comes Legion. And
yeah.
I have to say, I love the show. It's got to be the weirdest thing I've ever seen on television.
Well,
I remember when I was like in ninth grade, I saw Eraserhead.
Okay.
And for about an hour, I was like, oh, this is weird.
Yeah.
But then you watch Legion.
Yeah.
And all rules are off the table. It seems like Legion is really trying to get at what a mind is and what's real and what's not. And it's a show about consciousness. And it's a show about those dark spaces that we all sort of tend to distract ourselves from.
Yeah.
So that we do, you know what I mean?
And
I guess I'm just curious if, I mean, I look at that show and I go, this must be the very definition of blank canvas acting, where anything goes. Like, the rules are seem to be out the window.
Certainly some of them are. And it's funny, the ones that we sort of want to keep and the ones we want to get rid of, it's definitely a willfully different, very playful show. And yeah, I mean, it's such a weird set to be on, because the questions that get asked, just very practical questions, like, is that cup here? and everyone's like, I don't know, is the cup there? Yeah, the cup is there. Okay, good. You know, and then we'll carry on. And it's like, oh, right, we just had like a 3-minute conversation about whether that cup is there. But, you know, the nature of reality is at stake, you know. And, you know, playing with all these multiple realities and getting to what feels like sort of enlarge a sandbox, rather than just like, this is a show, it's set in this year, this is what happens, this is about this person and this person. It's, as you say, it's an experience, it's about the mind, it's about sort of going in and looking at all those different pockets, all those different characters that make up a mind, all the different voices that you absorb,
right.
You know, who you listen to, who you trust, what effect that has on you and the story that you then tell yourself about who you are. And it also happens to be about all sorts of psychic and psionic powers, but that's sort of incidental.
Right.
But it, at its heart, it's a love story. And there's, you know, the effect of love and what that has on a mind is, it's universal, I suppose. It's, you know, and so the rule book still applies to that, you know, a love story. But we come at it in a very interesting way, through a sort of labyrinth of really fun ideas.
Right. Or through taking 3 episodes and just throwing everything out and letting the audience be completely confused.
Right.
And just trusting that the audience is going to be around when some of these things get explained.
Yeah, and I think the way that we digest this kind of television now, it should be more like an experience, you know. And I think Noah very consciously wanted to create a show that was an experience delivery device rather than
Noah Hawley, the creator of the show.
Yeah. And, you know, one that would facilitate musical episodes, dance numbers, like, you know, you can really just sort of expand the boundaries of what's possible and give your actors, your audience, your writers a really, really fun time. And as a result, the props department, the camera, the costume, like, everybody is really, you know, stretching their capacity for imagination,
right.
and their ability to engage with a piece of material, with each other. And yeah, you know, standing in front of a camera behind which there's, you know, people using lenses they've haven't used before or not for years, or, you know, this incredible piece of kit will be wheeled on to get this one weird shot that we need, and I don't know, just everybody feels like they're sort of playing in a very interesting corner of the room, you know.
Well, you talked about Aubrey Plaza plays sort of a multifaceted parasitical mutant that has attached herself to your mind, and which I can't even, I'm not even going to try to explain the show because it's impossible.
Sure.
But
yeah.
But she plays
just
sort
imagine
of this
Aubrey
character.
Plaza attached to my mind, and,
yes.
and you've got the idea.
But you've described like times when she'll do something and you'll break character and laugh, and it doesn't matter that you've broken character and laughed because it worked for the scene as well. And you know, it just made me curious about if as an actor you sort of have to throw your self-critic out the window. And
yeah, I mean, it's certainly a show that we put our hands in into the editor.
Right.
We put ourselves in the hands of the editor, rather. And you know, Regis and Noah will construct something that might be very different to what was on the page. So our responsibility is just to be present for that particular reality that we're shooting that day. And that will be intercut with who knows what, with, you know, all sorts of crazy music. And yeah, it's really about a sort of presence of mind, I think, and a preparedness for almost anything.
Because you can come in and today you're going to be screaming in a black box for 4 hours.
Oh, at least 4 hours. Yeah, yeah. I think it's interesting what you were saying about the, you know, the Aubrey thing, and just realizing that there was certainly a realization that David found Lenny very funny, which became just becomes part of the show, that it wasn't this sort of serious drama about a schizophrenic young man who was misunderstood by the world, but actually, you know, having had the great fortune of meeting schizophrenics and talking to people who've either been affected by this condition or lived with people with that condition, some of their world, some of the time, is hysterical. Like, it's really, it's wildly funny. It's like, you know, it's like there's a sort of cosmic joke happening. And Legion is very much about the cosmic joke. And so that was a great discovery. And that really came through maniacal playing with Aubrey.
Right. I mean, is it, in your mind, is it a more freeing experience, this show, in terms of what you're allowed to do?
Well, there aren't as many parameters, I don't think. It's not a show that's trying to be prescriptive in any way, and it's taking all of us. I mean, it really is a sort of a collective effort, this show, and the cast as a whole were really in the dark season one as to what we were undertaking, which was fun. And then season two is a whole other trip. And so we're constantly just trying to sort of reconfigure what it is we're in and doing. But that in itself creates a certain kind of camaraderie. It's like a sort of support group mentality.
Right.
I'm like, what is happening right now? Like, did you just read that episode? Yeah, I read that episode. What's happening? I don't know.
The question has to come up of, does it matter?
Right.
I mean, have you had to sort of deal with that sort of level of
definitely
thinking?
Well, that's very freeing as well, in that as an actor you often get a little nosy and start worrying about things that are actually outside of your remit.
Would my character do that?
Or like, you know, what's this going to look like, and you know, what should the bed be like that, you know, or something. And it's just fussing around a performance, but it happens. And this show really encourages you just to forget, like, what ends up on your screen at the end of the day is not my job. My job is to be a part of that experience, that image, and you'll see me in various sort of guises through it. But I'm just part of that delivery device, as we all are.
Do you have a mechanism to judge your performance in Legion? Ooh. Or do you even try?
Increasingly, I think I make things with certain people in mind. So I'll make certain film choices based on, I'm in the mindset that I want to. I'm thinking about this group of people or this person. I want to make this for them.
Oh, that's interesting.
There's a certain group of people who Legion is definitely made for, and I know that they are enjoying it. So, yeah, I guess you know that's my sort of mechanism for being like, oh, it's working. Like I made this for you.
Oh, that's
the fact that other people enjoy it or don't like it is immaterial. And I've certainly made things for people and they've gone, yeah. And I'm going, okay, try harder. It might be just a small group of friends or one friend or my wife or my kids or something, but you know, there'll be somebody that I'm picturing them, you know, almost like handing them the DVD and being like, oh, I was thinking about you when I made this.
Right.
And that sort of helps me focus choices, perhaps, or a certain style. But it also leaves me open to doing different things in different ways, you know. Something that I make for my kids, you know, while I might want this group of people to enjoy it, it's really for them. And then I'll make something for that group of people that maybe my kids aren't old enough to watch it. So
that's funny. It's almost like you're describing how you compartmentalize the judgment or the audience for your work in a way of not having to take on the expectations of it having to be great for everybody.
You're not going to please everyone all the time, especially now where everybody's got a kind of, I thought this was terrible, like, outlet.
Right.
You know, maybe it was to you, and that's totally fine. But, you know, maybe I didn't make it for you. So, you know, you can say what you like, but I know that, you know, the person I made that for thought it was great, and that makes me very happy.
It's funny, there's this reductive thing that happens, right? When you first have an idea of a film or a character or a story, and it's sort of this massive thing, and then as you go through the process, reality takes on, okay, we have this many days to shoot it, or we have this many viewers, or this many people are going to see it, and something that you maybe prepped for 6 months and worked on for a year eventually comes down to that person, you know, spending 13 seconds.
The whole success of the film rides on one tweet.
Right.
I mean, I think just by virtue of being an actor and going through the process of auditioning for anything, you learn to develop a sense of how to deal with somebody saying no.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, just the more work you make and the higher profile that gets, I suppose, yeah, you've got to prepare yourself for people not liking stuff, and that's okay. You know, I don't like some stuff, but it doesn't mean it's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, because I find often, as I get older, the things that I end up enjoying the most are out of my comfort zone of what I think I would like.
And yeah.
If you're not following that same path of curiosity, then we're all making things in a protective manner rather than a...
Yes, yeah. And I think, I mean, that idea of challenging myself and my audience, you know, whoever that particular audience is,
right,
is a big part of it as well. Like, wanting to make something that I know they'll like, but that might surprise people. And I think the sort of the element of surprise and the element of kind of subverting a certain kind of expectation is quite, that's really fun to play with. Whether it's the medium or the message, but or both. But lulling people into thinking they're watching a certain kind of thing and flipping it on its head, that's a really delightful thing to be a part of. And Legion is very much, you know,
very much. I was about to say, I think you've succeeded in spades on Legion, because even if people read the one line thing, you know, the log line that it was based on a comic book, that's just sort of like, that's almost fake news.
It's a bit of a red herring. Yeah. I mean, it's not based on the comic book in that we don't take a particular storyline from like issue 374 to 385 and make that. But there's certainly an essence of the playfulness of comic books, the sense of humor, the way that medium, the comic book medium, is it uses what's essentially a sort of a childhood piece of hardware, a lightweight flippy magazine and bright, colorful pictures to explore really epic, humanist, you know, cosmic ideas.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Like that to me is what's awesome about comic books. And to feel like that's part of our adaptation. It's not that we're taking, you know, specific frames. Although specific frames have influenced certain moments of Legion, I think, you know, the physicality and the facial expression and the kind of just the demeanor of him is certainly infused through those comic books. But Noah told us not to read them, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't stop me, you know, you can tell me not to read something, it doesn't mean I'm not going to read it. But he didn't want people to get too tied into, but in this, you know, it says here, you know, it's like, no.
I guess it's the experience on that has to be the most dynamic of all your experiences, because you get to go so many places, I would think, right?
Yeah,
from dancing and singing to having a complete emotional breakdowns.
Yeah. I mean, I've certainly found that spirit on the smallest of indie sets as well, just the ambition. And I think Legion's confirmed it for me, but I always suspected that filmmaking is really, it's an exercise in collective madness. So it's, you know, one madman, writer, director, whoever, has had this idea, and she or he comes to another person, say, and that could be their DP or their producing partner or whatever, and is like, I've had this mad idea, here it is. Or, you know, it might be two lines, it might be 200 pages, but it's like,
right,
what do you think? You know, and it's like the mad person sharing their madness. Now, if that other person says, you're fucking mad, that's not going to happen. That's it. But if that other person says, oh, that's kind of cool, or like, wow, that's mad in a good way, let's make that. And then you go to a wider group of people and a wider group of people. And, you know, before too long, you might have 30, 40 people who've all read this piece of madness and gone, wow, that's beautiful, let's make that. You know, some of these people might have been working in the industry for 40 years, and they're like, boof, I've never seen that before, you know, which Legion does frequently.
Yeah.
You know, we've got some wonderful crew who've, you know, they've done everything, and, you know, they'll still occasionally, like, look up from the lens and be like, whoa.
Well, that's why we all got into this in the first place, I think, is because you want your weird idea to be accepted, and you want to find your weird group and make something that turns you on.
I think so. I think It's possible. And it's, you know, it's a show that's very much about creating your own reality, or you know, which reality you choose to go along with. And that's a really, it's a fun thing to explore creatively, you know, with a group of artists, group of like-minded creative people. It's like, Oh, we can actually make this whole set a really fun, cool, exciting place to be.
Right, which is not that dissimilar to you starting The Junket, your literary magazine. Like, okay, the way I'm gonna get anything done is by inventing it myself and not waiting for someone to give it to me.
Yes, I think, I mean, certainly one of the great things that I learned from my contemporaries was that, yeah, you know, you surround yourself with good people, whatever that means to you, but, you know, the right people that make you feel a certain way, that think a certain way, encourage you to create things in a certain way.
Right.
And that anything is possible. Like, really, if you know, and again, it's that the madman sharing their ideas. You know, if you find another mad person who thinks you're maybe not so mad, like, that's the most beautiful thing in the world. And
did you find that at Cambridge?
Definitely. I found people who weren't embarrassed to talk about the books they were reading. And, like, that was actually kind of a cool thing to do. And you know, they also liked drum and bass or hip hop or whatever, you know, and
right,
that these things weren't mutually exclusive. And exploding that world of, like, oh, it's not compartmentalized at all.
Right.
It's like you can literally make your own compartments.
And I think I read that you also, like, tried stand-up comedy around that time as well. Like, how did you end up on, you know, in front of people doing comedy?
Because I'd always wanted to do it. Yeah, I knew that comedy club existed, was available to join, and I'd always wanted to try it. I had no ambitions to be a stand-up full-time, I don't think, but I've always loved watching it, and I just admire it as an art form. I think anybody who tries it is incredibly brave, and, you know, it's a really raw medium where it's your words, you know, that you've come up with whenever. But,
well, it's you.
It's you. One microphone. I did go to a stand-up club in Dublin. I didn't perform, but it's one of the oldest stand-up clubs in the world, and there's no microphone. And it's like, it's a sort of rite of passage through that city that you go and you hold a set with no microphone, and that's something, because you can really hide behind that thing if things aren't going great. You can just kind of sink in, you know, that sort of dead sound into the mic. But no mic, that was sort of, it was thrilling to watch. But yeah, just, you know, you and your words and a microphone and a bunch of people, and you know instantly whether it's working. That's the thing about comedy.
Instant feedback.
It's not like I've delivered some tragic monologue and afterwards people say, that was so beautiful, that was, you know, and they prepare their thoughts or something.
Right.
This is just instant guttural feedback. And that was really exciting.
What did you learn about yourself from doing that?
Well, I learned that if I was to do that with somebody who really knew what they were doing and they're, you know, some really good writing, then I'd be fine. So like I said, I had no ambitions to take that to the wider world. I don't think they necessarily needed to hear my thoughts in that form. But it taught me about making things work on stage and an interaction with an audience and just, you know, feeling yeah, rhythms of laughter and all that kind of thing. It's an amazing thing to sort of experience.
Did you ever have a full night of bombing where?
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I would think,
dead,
you know,
sound. And it's just like, you just got to, I don't know. It's like you sort of just, you're just like fumbling in the dark for some kind of rope that you laid out the night before. It's like, well, this is how it's going to go. And then there's just nothing coming back. Or so, I mean, it's a long time ago, but.
I read something about the Amused Moose.
Oh, God, that's a comedy club.
Right, is that in London?
Yeah. Yeah. God, I wonder if that still exists. But yeah, that was one of the few times we came down to London and sort of tried that, you know, student-y material.
Oh, so it was like, we're doing it at Cambridge, we're going to go take it to the big
which
city.
Which is a very safe environment. You know, it's like 11 o'clock on a Tuesday night and everybody's hammered and you know, a bunch of people get up and do all sorts of strange things and some of them are funny and some of them are weird or whatever, but it's just a great, like, hour of nonsense and people generally have a pretty good time, but yeah, it's a pretty safe crowd. I think generally, like, student audiences are pretty receptive to weird stuff.
But then you take it to London and...
Take it to London, it's a whole different beast, yeah.
Right.
But that in itself teaches you something. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, this is a bubble, and we have to get out of that bubble and explore wider.
Hey, folks, Sam Jones here. Has your company outgrown QuickBooks? Are shared spreadsheets, manual processes, and legacy systems costing you time and money? Well, now's the time to move your business to the cloud. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform. With NetSuite, you can save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance and accounting, orders, and HR instantly, right from your desk or even your phone. Thousands of the best-known brands and fastest-growing companies use NetSuite to manage their business. And now it's available to you. The power of the world's most popular cloud management system is more affordable than you think. Right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights to overcome the obstacles that are holding you back. For free. Don't miss out on unleashing your business's full potential with this free guide, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth. You'll learn how to acquire new customers, increase profits, and finally get real visibility into your cash flow. Get NetSuite's guide, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth, when you go to netsuite.com/offcamera. That's netsuite.com/offcamera. So check that out. And now let's get back to the show.
Are you naturally extroverted in a room, or do you think that it's becoming a character where you feel free to, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like there are some people.
What's the room? Who's in the room?
Okay.
How many people are in the room? What am I wearing? What day is it? What time of day is it?
So no concerns about being in the room at all.
Well, it depends. I mean, yeah.
I mean, is there
what
character
building is the
to
room
hide
in?
Behind?
You know, who owns the room? How much am I being paid to be in the room? Like, I don't know.
I think you've answered the question.
But, I mean, there are certain characters I've taken on that are not that comfortable to wear in a way. Like, there was something in them that I just saw, I wanted to explore. There was an idea, you know, a concept or something I just wanted to be a part of. But it doesn't mean that they're at that happier place to live. You know, and there's even times like Legion where, you know, there's some really odd, dark turns in that show that they don't feel... You know, it's not like I sort of stroll into work and it's like another day on Legion, you know, and it's like all cozy every day. Some days are really weird and hard, but in terms of like being myself and going into a room, I don't know. Like I say, it depends on the day of the week, I think. I wouldn't say I'm the kind of guy that walks into a room and has to be the center of attention in that room as myself. I don't think that's who I am, but... In terms of like the work that I put out there, I enjoy people's reactions to it, positive or negative now, I think.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got better at taking the negative thing because, yeah, just over time you get a bit less sensitive about that. And like I said, I think more about my choices now and I can justify almost all of them, you know, in a pretty reasonable way to myself. And so, yeah, if somebody doesn't enjoy this show or this movie, then that's okay. Let's talk about that, you know.
Right. Is there a through line that you can see post Downton Abbey of the choices that you've made? Like, can you connect them in terms of a master plan or I guess I'm just curious if you can look at what you've done since that show and gone, oh yeah, I see what I'm doing and I'm...
I don't know if there was a, if it's a route map as such, but yeah, I could look back on the last 5 years from a sort of a bird's eye view and be like, oh yeah, that looks neat. But when you're in it, I'm not thinking about it constantly in those
right.
terms.
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, when I think of life up to Downton Abbey, I mean, there's certainly a lot of BBC costume drama in your past, and
sure.
and it seems like, gosh, you could have been on that track and been very comfortable there.
Yeah.
And have you ever heard of David Caruso? He was the actor in the 90s who was on NYPD Blue.
Oh, NYPD, yes, okay. And he left at the height of...
He left at the height of sort of yes, his
okay.
thing, and he left because, you know, he didn't get the raise he wanted, and he thought he was going to have all these leading man parts in films, and he went
right.
off, and it didn't go so well for him.
Okay.
So much so that I think the New York Times wrote this story about one of the biggest blunders career-wise ever in the history of television.
Oh, God.
No, and I remember when it was announced that you were leaving Downton, and I
yeah.
thought in my head, God, I wonder if he's pulling a David Caruso.
Is he the next Caruso?
Right,
I see.
And
I see.
Clearly what you've done, and this
yeah.
is where I think... I ask if you have a master plan, because it's kind of brilliant, the choices that you've made. Like, each role you've taken on, it's almost like the next one, you're going to shatter people's expectations once again. I guess I'm curious if this idea of wanting to take a left turn from where it seemed everyone was comfortable with your career going.
Yeah.
And even to the point of leaving the UK and coming to the United States.
I actively was looking to do as wide a variety of things as anybody would let me do.
Right.
And that continues to be the case, I think. And yeah, the opportunity came up to come over here to do a play here initially in New York.
Right, The Heiress, right?
Right.
Jessica Chastain
and David Strathairn. And that in itself was an incredible education of just, you know, The Heiress taking place in a Downton Abbey-ish kind of world, but a slightly more roguish character than I'd played for the previous 3 years, and so it was sort of beginning the step away from that. And and then I got a movie that shot in Brooklyn, and it just seemed like a good time to sort of hop over, make that, and see what else might be available. And that it was Scott Frank's film, A Walk Among the Tombstones, with
right,
Liam
right.
Neeson, and it was just a very dark film in the manner of those really dark 70s sort of thrillers that I hadn't seen made for years, you know, and I was like, oh, I really love that. I love those kind of movies. Let's, you know, let's get stuck into that. And that was the beginning of it, really. That was the first spark of somebody being open to the idea, and like, oh, I've never seen you do that. Let's see you try, rather than I've never seen you do that.
So you can't.
I don't think you can do that.
Right.
You know,
well, that's
which is the end of imagination. That's like, but I can.
Yeah.
You know, and any actor out there will tell you, like, I mean, if they're being honest with themselves, not every role, but like a lot of roles, they'll look at and be like, I could do this, you know. And it takes somebody on the other side to say, you can do this, you know. And it's finding those connections, really.
And that's what I'm talking about, because I have tremendous respect for the fact that you were able to walk away from something that, if we're being honest, most people probably couldn't do that at that point, because A, it's a steady job, and B, there's a lot of fame associated with it, which means salary, it means, you know, longevity in a world.
Yeah, it means all sorts of things in this day and age, I
right.
think.
Because, look, I think every actor goes through that thing of, gosh, I want to work, I want to have steady work, but I also don't want to get pigeonholed in the place where they only see me as one way. And you sort of wrestled that away at the height of it going one direction.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we should all be so lucky that we have the chance to break away from that thing that...
But most people don't.
No, because we're conditioned not to, really. And, you know, I'd done a fair number, as you say, I'd done a fair number of sort of period costume drama, because we make a lot of that kind of thing
right.
in England, and that is, you know, that's where the majority of us start out, whether it's in theatre or doing those parts in you know, a Jane Austen or a Dickens or something.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good work out there for British actors in that kind of stuff. But I, you know, I'd grown up watching American movies, and obviously, you know, we're very influenced by the American culture over there, and particularly the film thing was, for one reason or another, eluding me over there, and you know, that was probably as much to do with me and my own self-challenging. But once I came over here and that door was open to me, and the exploration began, it was like, oh, now let's see you do, you know, the psychopathic military guy from Kentucky. And it's like, oh,
right.
Cool. I've never done that before, and could never have done that staying in England. You know, that's something that inherently requires to step outside and find an American who thinks, you know, just the idea of putting that guy from Downton Abbey in this movie is,
yeah,
in itself hysterical.
You know, I think it is notable that you did this and took that chance, because I don't think many people would, and I think that it does sort of define you as an artist. Your choices sort of, by definition, make you the kind of artist you are. And I imagine it took some courage, though.
Yeah.
I'm not getting over the fact that...
No, it was a few long, long, dark nights.
Sure.
And, you know, long conversations with my wife, you know, with two small kids, being like, okay, so...
So I'm going to
quit. I'm going to quit this thing.
And yeah. And
maybe we're going to move 3,000 miles that way and, you know...
And start over.
Yeah. But yeah. Again, a bit like the creative endeavor, you know, having a partner in life who meets that mad idea and doesn't run in the other direction, but says, oh, that's kind of beautiful. I want to come on that adventure. You know, and the kids, unfortunately, don't get a say at that point. Maybe now they might, but it's too late. but yeah, you know, having the love and support of somebody, you know, who can sort of hold your hand through those moments where it's like, it's going to be okay. Something good is going to come out of this. That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, that is funny that you describe it that way, because that's exactly what we're saying. You had this mad idea, and you didn't, you know, if you had taken it to your wife and she would have said, oh, that's a terrible idea.
Yeah. I'm very well could not be here right now.
Right. Because these films that you took on, they weren't big assured successes at all. You took some left field choices.
I don't know. They never feel that left field to me. They just feel interesting, you know. And I guess maybe that being left field is inherently interesting to me. But like you say, the sort of definition in terms of, oh, well, what did I just do? Oh, I did something, you know, a big broad comedy for the kids. Let's do a very dark, intense drama, you know, just to sort of balance it out. And I think I must have up there some sort of, you know, checking account or something where I'm just sort of balancing,
right?
You know, the light with the dark, hopefully, as best I can.
Right. Well, I mean, to me, I look at the guy who wrote those essays in The Junket, and then the guy who's the Beast in a giant Disney film.
Yeah, not necessarily the same guy.
But I wonder if it's the same guy to you.
It is the same guy, I suppose. One's wearing stilts. He's a bit more angry about things. But the essays are, you know, I mean, I haven't been doing them so much recently, and The Junket is...
Think about the space you've created, that you have a wide field of play, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds easy to say it, you know, the other side of it all, but it is possible. Like, you can, if you want to write an essay about something, and you can do that. And, you know, that's the wonderful thing about writing as opposed to acting, you know.
And if you want to be in a billion-dollar Disney franchise, you can do
that.
You can
just do that, yeah. But, I mean, that was a wonderful coincidence of things that,
sure.
You know, and that was, you know, similar to the Downton Abbey phenomenon, really, that was not something that predictable. You know, when we came over to the States, I didn't have this grand plan, and I didn't have these roles laid out, you know, for me or my wife to say, oh, we're going over here and we're going to do this, then we're going to do this, then we're going
to
do this.
That will lead to
just this sort of vast openness, which I suppose is the American way, isn't it?
Just the American dream.
The drive west, the open plain.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, something that you said about starting The Junket, which I found incredibly inspiring, was you talked about a group of friends that would go down to the pub and talk about it.
Yeah.
For a long time.
A lot of pubbing and a lot of talking. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you said at some point you just have to actually do it and stop talking about it.
Yeah, there was a point in our mid to late 20s, I suppose, where, yeah, the sort of the alcohol and conversation ratio to work produced was sort of wildly out of joint.
You had your checks in your head. You had to bring the alcohol down and get the work production.
But also
up.
Just a really, it's that collective imagination to say, yeah, let's just put this thing together and make it happen. And you know,
again, you said, here's a weird idea, and no one said no.
No one said no.
You ought to test this power you have.
Everybody has it, I'm told.
You ought to say, hey, I'm going to make a flying car. You know, and then just...
Yeah, but when you look into flying cars, they're incredibly dangerous.
They are.
I mean, just, yeah, I've looked into it, trust me. Me and Elon. We've been sitting down for a while now, and it's just, I don't know, it's a great idea, but...
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Conceptually brilliant, but in practice, it's just a nightmare.
Did Elon shut you down?
No, we're working on it.
Okay.
Well, I've never met Elon Musk, for the record.
By the way, after this conversation, I'm sure
Elon
you
Musk
will
is going to call. Yeah. So about that flying car idea, yeah. Dan. I'm like, oh, thanks for calling, Elon.
Cut to 5 years later, you're sitting here again. So we're sitting in a flying car.
What happened to the acting? I was like, well, I got into flying cars and, yeah.
Well, I have to close with something. And speaking of the American West and flying cars.
Yes.
My daughter and I took a road trip last summer, and my daughter loves to sing. She's got a giant imagination. She plays music. She draws. She writes. And she fell in love with Beauty and the Beast. And so every day, multiple times during the drive, we would have to put on Beauty and the Beast, and I would have
our
to
version?
Sing. Yes, and
okay.
I would have to sing the part of the Beast,
of course.
And she would sing the part of Belle.
That's what it's there for.
Well, but anyway, it got me thinking that there's a character in that voice, in the singing, that conjures up the face of the Beast, and you managed to create a voice that fit, like we're talking about, this idea that even in radio, that you could see the character through the voice.
Yes. Yeah,
I was curious about, first off, if having to learn to sing for that film or having to sing in that film, if that brought up a different level of insecurity, or again, if it was just the work of creating a character that allowed you to sing. And
it was quite terrifying because I've never sung on that larger stage.
I wondered about that. I wondered
before.
I
have sung on stage,
uh-huh.
But not professionally, not for a while. And so that in itself was kind of like, oh. Okay, but again, looking at the kind of actor that I'd always imagined that I would be, that I'd wanted to be, they could do it all, you know, and you look at sort of golden age Hollywood, like they could sing and dance and act and, you know, have fun and cry. And, you know, there was a skill set, there was a tool bag that you came with that was pretty entry level. You know, it wasn't like, oh, look, he's dancing. Like, it's like, yeah, he's dancing. He's an actor, he's working, you know. He should be dancing. And dance and physicality has become a huge part of what I do. And singing now, on top of that, I've been singing in Legion again. You know, there's all sorts of areas where I'm using my voice in different ways. But finding a way that the Beast would sound in and amongst this insane technology that was being used. And the way I looked on set was so inherently just crazy. I looked like a giant hippo, you know, on stilts. And
right.
But it really came out of teeth, about these fangs that they made when we were maybe going to use the sort of prosthetic route instead of a sort of CGI. And we went through all sorts of kind of fittings, and they gave me these incredible fangs, and I took these fangs away and was sort of playing with these fangs. And just thinking about the kind of guy that, you know, what sort of a despicable guy the prince was, and what this kind of curse would have meant to him, and having these fangs and wanting to hide them, and sort of downturning the mouth to sort of play down this sort of thing, and being incredibly
posh. It's amazing, your
suddenly,
voice just got deep.
And suddenly it just sort of, and the larynx starts to change, and you sort of spoke out the bottom of his mouth, and then you find this character that I was like, oh, that there he is. You know, it just sort of, there was something that clicked. And then the mournful ballad that Alan Menken wrote, you know, it just sits so perfectly in that voice.
Did you put the fangs in to sing it?
No. I did try. It was just hopeless. but yeah, that was a very kind of auditory thing where I was just like, oh, and it just like, it tilts the larynx in such a way that you just speak differently. And then you sort of, you know, and that's informed by a physicality that, I don't know. It's like a weird matrix of things. But it can be from like how somebody holds their shoulders or something. And that, you know, that affects the amount of air you can take into your lungs, and you start talking differently. You know, there's just different ways of being, I guess. But that was how I sort of found that voice.
Something else you said that really struck me is you want to be the kind of actor that can do it all. And I think right there, that's the thing. Like, you're going to sing even if it terrifies you because that's what you do. And it seems like, same with your career. It's like you don't seem like you're going to limit yourself to anything.
But if I'd said, I don't sing, you know, I would never have made that movie. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't even have put myself forward. I wouldn't have got the role. Like,
right.
None of that would have happened if I'd been the kind of actor who'd be like, I don't do musicals. Like, I hadn't done musicals until that point, but I'd like to, and I love watching them, and when they're great, they're wonderful, you know. Did I always want to be a part of that? Yeah. So let's give it a go, you know. And again, Bill Condon, he saw something in you know, I don't know, he saw something that was prepared to take on that challenge and be, you know, be the beast that he needed for that particular right. telling of that tale, you know.
And who knows if Noah Hawley saw that and said, he can be, you know, this schizophrenic but yeah. not mutant. Yeah, it's yeah. incredible how you've opened up that scape for yourself. And watching the choices you've made and the films you've made has been incredible. And it's been great getting to know you a little bit.
Thank you. Great to meet you.
Yeah, thanks for trying to get, you know, trying to have discourse on the meta level. It's challenging.
On this astral plane.
Yes. The white room.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hey folks, that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed that. And if you haven't seen Legion, I suggest you dive right in and hang on for the ride. It's the most unique show on television and well worth your time. Also, you should see The Guest and prepare to discover a completely different Dan Stevens in that film. And finally, check out Dan's literary magazine, thejunket.org. I suggest starting with his piece, The Invisible Watch. Who says handsome British actors can't also be intellectual essayists? So check that out. So, as you probably know, because I say it every week, Off Camera is also a television show. You can check that out on DirecTV's Audience Network or by going to offcamera.com. And there you can find every episode archived and available to watch on any device. You can also subscribe to our Off Camera magazine, and you can buy back issues and even pick up a copy of Off Camera, The Portraits, which is a 275-page coffee table book filled with my photographs of every iconic artist that has appeared on Off Camera. And just know that when you spend money at the Off Camera store or by getting yourself a monthly subscription, you are supporting Off Camera, which helps us bring these creative conversations to you each week. So check all of that out. I want to thank everyone that works hard on the show: Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Sasha Snow, Kara Johnson, and Matt Nine Fingers Davidson. And if you want to tell the world about us, and please do, we are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. So don't keep us a secret. If you like what you're hearing, tell your friends. And if you want to reach out personally, I'm just an email away. You can send me your guest suggestions, comments, criticisms, recipes, or just say hi. I'm sam@offcamera.com. And lastly, and most importantly, please join me next time when I sit down with actor and Coen Brothers muse, John Goodman.
I got to New York in 1975. I was hanging out at a joint called the Cafe Central, and there was a lot of great actors that hung out in there. They were working, and I was doing commercials, and I just really beat myself up over that. I'd get so heated up. There were times when I would go into Central Park looking for a fight, but I was scared all the time, too. But if I didn't go to New York, I would have kicked myself in the ass for the rest of my life.
I was really moved by John's tough upbringing and stories of his struggles in New York in the 1970s. I mean, he lived the life of an actor, warts and all. But what really got me was the dichotomy between his commanding physical presence and his seeming fragility of confidence. John has embodied some of the most memorable roles on film and television, and yet still struggles with the notion of whether or not he has any talent at all. I guess that's the true definition of an artist. See you next time. Off Camera.